Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice concluded a two-day weekend trip this Monday to Israel and the Palestinian territories ahead of President Bush's trip next week. Rice held talks on various issues, including Israeli checkpoints and manned roadblocks in the West Bank, in hopes of displaying progress towards peace. The reason for Bush's trip is the 60th anniversary of the founding of Israel, which Palestinians refer to as al-Nakba, or the catastrophe. Following Rice's departure, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas and Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert met to discuss prospects for peace. Not prominently mentioned, however, was the continuing siege of Gaza. Former President Jimmy Carter recently met with the Hamas government despite criticism from Bush and Olmert. As an outcome of the meetings, Hamas has now offered to accept the State of Israel and is willing to call a 10-year truce. Meanwhile, violence continues in besieged Gaza as a Palestinian mother and four of her children were killed last week during an Israeli attack. The Israeli military has claimed that Palestinian militants targeted in the missile strike carried explosives that were responsible for the deaths. Joining me in studio this morning is Anna Balzer. She's a Fulbright scholar, author, and volunteer with the International Women's Peace Service and the author of Witness in Palestine, a Jewish-American woman in the occupied territories. Welcome to Uprising, Anna.
Thanks for having me, Sonali.
So you're here in the Southern California area doing a number of speaking events about the time you spent in the occupied territories. We'll give our listeners some information about that. Condoleezza Rice, in her trip, has tried to show that there is progress towards peace between the Israelis and the Palestinians. What has your experience personally shown regarding any progress?
The sense I've gotten from Palestinians is that it's not so much what Israeli leaders say or what U.S. leaders say as what they see on the ground. And what we find oftentimes is that there is no change on the ground. There's simply lip service paid to the idea of peace or the idea of loosening the noose around Palestinians' neck. But the noose is still very much there, and that's what's important to Palestinian people. I think also an important thing to remember is that within any kind of progress, we would need to see the involvement of Palestinians. And what is absent now is the involvement of the democratically elected government of the Palestinian people. And the idea that somehow you can negotiate a settlement without including the people that Palestinians have elected to represent them, I think is absurd.
Hmm. So the issue of checkpoints, for example, you witnessed checkpoints while you were there. How have they changed, if at all, over the years? Have they gotten stricter? Has it gotten harder for Palestinians to move around?
There's an interesting thing that happens in that on the outside they may seem a little bit less violent, in the sense that a few years ago when I started going to Palestine, it would be a young 18-year-old Israeli soldier clutching a gun and yelling and screaming at Palestinians, perhaps using violence. And then a year later, it would be that they had actually installed metal turnstiles so that Palestinians would wait sort of like animals for the soldiers to push a button to let them continue through. And now we have these places replaced by something called terminals, where there is almost no human interaction at all between Palestinians and soldiers, and they're simply barked. Orders are barked at them, and they have to follow the orders in order to get through. So what we find, whether or not there are fewer checkpoints, first of all, the idea of checkpoints between not Palestinian cities and towns and Israeli cities and towns, but between Palestinian towns and other towns, between Palestinians and their hospitals, their schools, their jobs, their basic services, is absurd to begin with, but is not conducive to peace, to say the least. But not only that, we're seeing them institutionalized to an extent that is very disturbing.
So this tragic killing last week of the Palestinian mother and four of her children during an Israeli attack. You know, we hear about these dramatic incidents, but they do happen on a nearly daily basis in the occupied territories. The Israeli military is claiming that it wasn't their fault, but they're investigating themselves.
Yeah, well, I think this is just one more example. I mean, it's very consistent with the policies, the patterns of the Israeli army killing civilians. I mean, just I looked at the statistics today. Last year in 2007, it was more than 300 Palestinian civilians and around 13 Israelis. And we know the names of those Israelis. We hear about them day after day after day, and yet the Palestinians are nameless, they're faceless, they're just casualties of war. And this is just exemplary of first of all, the bias in U.S. mainstream media, as well as the brutal tactics of the Israeli army.
Now, some have pointed to dissent within the Israeli Defense Forces, the fact that there is a mandatory service and that there are, you know, a lot of young folks who have to serve who are trying to resist that service. Some have pointed to that as a reason to be very hopeful. Is that, in your opinion, something that can be relied upon to change things substantially?
That's an excellent question. I mean, certainly it is. A nice thing to see so many Israelis resisting. But I think we too often have the assumption that change will come from the very populations that are profiting off of, that are that are institutionalizing or carrying out the atrocities.
And is this dissent based on a real sort of moral abhorrence of what is happening in the occupation, or is it simply that it's unpleasant to serve in the army?
I think it's both. I mean, I've certainly met refuseniks refuseniks oftentimes have to sacrifice a great deal. We're talking about young 18-year-olds who will not have certain professional doors open to them if they refuse to serve, who are spending prime years in jail, ostracized by their families. So I actually think that it's commendable that young people are able to make such a choice of conscience oftentimes. But I think the point about is that the way that change happens is an important one. Martin Luther King's great quote, I always say it in talks, freedom is never voluntarily given by the oppressor. It must be demanded by the oppressed. It is not going to be Israeli society that leads the change until it becomes truly painful, truly difficult for Israel to continue. And that's why we advocate things like boycott, divestment, sanctions to sort of disrupt business as usual.
My guest is Anna Balzer. She is joining me in studio and in the L.A. area for a number of events. She's going to be at Cal State Long Beach today, 12 noon, and tomorrow she'll be at the Holy Cross Melkite Greek Catholic Church in Placentia, 7:30 p.m. Cypress College on May 8th at 2:30 p.m. She'll be in San Diego on May 9th, Studio City May 10th, Long Beach again May 12th, and Irvine May 14th, as well as at UCLA on May 14th. For all of her events and the details of where and when they are, you can visit her website, annainthemiddleeast.com. That's her site. And also you can find out information about her book, Witness in Palestine, A Jewish American Woman in the Occupied Territories, as well as a DVD that's based on her talks. So let's talk about the Nakba Day, as Palestinians refer to it. We're coming upon May 15th, a day that Israelis celebrate as the day that Israel was founded 60 years ago. For Palestinians, of course, a completely different day. As a Jewish American woman, what does this day mean to you?
Well, I, as a Jewish person, reject the idea that I have some sort of a birthright to a place that Palestinians were kicked out of. I mean, I think when we talk about Israel and its quote-unquote independence, we have to talk about what is meant by Israel. And Israel is not the state of its citizens. It's not the state of the people who live in it. It's the state of the Jewish people. And by its very nature of being a Jewish state, it excludes the Christian and Muslim and other populations that were living in this area for generations before Israel was created. In fact, in order to create a Jewish state in a place where the majority was not Jewish, required Zionist forces basically ethnically cleansing the non-Jewish population from the area. So I think to celebrate something like that, to deny Palestinians their right of return, as well as the acknowledgement of the Nakba, the catastrophe that they have suffered, but to celebrate the foundation of a state that was based on their ethnic cleansing, is something that I, as a Jewish person, and I think think all of us as human beings need to reject. Not only that, but you know, if there are celebrations of the 60th anniversary of Israel, I think it behooves us to disrupt those things, to remind people that what Israel means, what having a Jewish state means. Maybe we understand the reason for wanting a Jewish state, and then we can also understand that what that has had to mean, and that and as I say, I reject the idea that I have a birthright there when Palestinians were kicked out of it.
There is an effort by 100 British Jewish anti-Zionists to say that they're boycotting the anniversary of the founding of the State of Israel. They say, we're not celebrating Israel's anniversary, in a letter that they published in Britain's Guardian newspaper. Is there any kind of a similar effort here in the United States?
Absolutely. I'm part of a group of anti-Zionist Jews who's recently published a petition as well as sort of a whole campaign surrounding the idea of the title is No Time to Celebrate, and celebrating Palestinian resistance and commemorating the Nakba, but rejecting the idea of celebrating the creation of this state.
Mm. Anna, what do you think of the heads of state that from the United States who seem to have a stake in what happens personally in the occupied territories and Israel? First of all, of course, President Bush, who would like to see himself leave his office with a legacy of having done maybe one thing right, which is achieve the impossible, the peace in Israel and the occupied territories. And then former President Jimmy Carter, who has written a very strong book using the word apartheid. But of course, he's not in office anymore, so it doesn't matter as much. What do you make of these efforts?
Well, again, the lip service means nothing. What matters is what is actually done. I mean, in Carter's case, I actually very much respect the fact that the man has, for example, been talking to Hamas, which I think is absolutely appropriate. The fact that he's written a book that has introduced or let's say popularized this framework of apartheid, which I think is absolutely appropriate. I don't agree with everything in his book, but I very much think he's helped the movement. But take Bush, for example. I mean, the idea that you would claim that you want to see a peace resolved in a very short period of time, nice idea, but simultaneously we happen to be giving more than $10 million a day to support the aggressor, the State of Israel, as it continues to colonize the Palestinian areas and lay siege on places like Gaza. So I think, again, this idea that it's not so much what people say, but what people do. And you take, for example, Hamas, which has ideologically opposed the idea of a Jewish state, a state that excludes Christians and Muslims, but that has actually shown that it is capable of holding onto a ceasefire. So that's an example of, let's look at the actions rather than what people are saying, whereas the Israeli government says it wants peace, and yet in a short period of time is capable of killing tens, if not hundreds, of Palestinian civilians.
Mm. And when I say achieving the impossible, I mean that for President Bush, certainly peace is never impossible. You mentioned earlier in the interview sanctions and other things, but sort of long-term wise, broadly speaking, I don't know if this is indulgent to talk about or not, but would you classify yourself as a two-stater or one-stater?
Well, I think the two-state solution doesn't address any of the fundamental issues in this conflict. I mean, it may solve certain things for certain Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza, but most of them are refugees. You know, the majority of the Palestinians are refugees, and having a one state for Palestinians, one state for Jews does not solve the problem of, first of all, the refugees needing having the right to return to their homes, but also the idea of a state, an ethnocentric. An ethnocentric nationalist state where rights are dependent on your religion, are dependent on your ethnicity. I think there's something fundamentally problematic about that idea, as well as obviously the fact that refugees have rights to return to their home, and that would not be addressed by a two-state solution. So a one-state really opens the door to democracy. It's a scary notion for a lot of people because it means that Israel would lose its Jewish Jewish character, its artificial Jewish character, because, of course, it was created intentionally, artificially, but it certainly would open the door to democracy.
Anna Baltzer, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Anna Baltzer is a Fulbright scholar, author, and volunteer with the International Women's Peace Service. She's the author of Witness in Palestine, A Jewish American Woman in the Occupied Territories. You can find out all about her speaking events all the way. She, in fact, started a tour on May 1st, going through May 14th all across Southern California. Her website is annainthemiddleeast.com, and we'll link to that from our website, uprisingradio.org, later today. For Sonali, Subversive Thought for the Day, I'd like to quote Miriam Makeba, who once said, "Everybody now admits that apartheid was wrong. I just told the world the truth, and if my truth then becomes political, I can't do anything about that." That's Miriam Makeba, and that's Sonali's Subversive Thought for the Day.